Take over.
Sure, thank you, Lars. So it's a pleasure to try and tell you about the whole history of our universe in 45 minutes on the blackboard. One of the disadvantages of preparing a blackboard talk with a few notes is, of course, you forget them at home in the morning. So anyway, six parts to this. Immediately. So the first chapter is the physics that we need to understand to understand star and galaxy formation. And the simple starting point is a sphere, beloved by all theorists. And essentially, physics can be boiled down to gravity, of course, which is trying to compress this sphere, whatever this sphere is. So it's going to have some radius, some mass. There is self-gravity acting to compress this structure. And really, the complexity of star formation, galaxy formation, really comes from the processes which are trying to stop that collapse. So those processes are various kinds of pressure forces, from simple thermal pressure just NKT, the gas at some temperature, but also, as we'll see, turbulent pressure. You think of a microphysical turbulent velocity dispersion, which if there's a gradient in that velocity dispersion exerts a pressure. Magnetic. The interstellar medium, the intergalactic medium is magnetized. Those magnetic fields have an energy density, they have a pressure. Potentially also cosmic rays, so populations of relativistic particles, maybe with non-thermal velocity distributions. So all these kinds of pressure terms may resist the collapse here, and so we have outward pressure forces trying to stop this collapse. There's also rotation. Shear in a particular structure which can stabilize the system. So to solve this...
How about Fermi pressure?
Fermi pressure.
Yeah.
From the vacuum.
Degenerate cores, right? Degenerate.
Well, once you get to planets, degenerate, yes, of course. Once you have, but in the interstellar medium, intergalactic medium, degeneracy pressure is not relevant. But as we'll see, we get to stars, it is. So yes, ultimately, things are trying to not go into black holes, and degeneracy pressure will stop that for most objects, in fact. Okay, so to solve this system, it's basically a whole bunch of coupled differential equations which describe these physical processes. We need to basically understand some of the following processes here for each associated with each of these pressures. So of course, heating and cooling for thermal pressure, turbulence can be generated by various processes. So depending on from either small scale, as we'll see, feedback, or large scale, the cascade of turbulence from large scale motions, and its decay. Now, often, as we'll see, the turbulence is supersonic in the interstellar medium, so often you have shocks, and that's a source of decay of this turbulence. Then magnetic fields, so we need to understand about dynamos in various situations, and then the diffusion of the field, depending on if the gas is mostly neutral or not, or reconnection, how magnetic flux separates itself from the mass of the interstellar medium. Cosmic rays, of course, particle acceleration, abbreviate a lot here, and then fusion and energy losses associated with those particles, those relativistic particles. And then rotation, I'll just write angular momentum evolution. That's often influenced by, in fact, magnetic field coupling to the various structures. So we have to solve these processes, and then we have to start getting into things like astrochemistry. of the, whatever the interstellar medium is made of. So that's the astrochemistry of gas. To understand its constituents, which may affect, for example, cooling, we'll describe the gas content with the metallicity, typically, capital Z. So what heavy elements? So for astronomers, everything above helium is metal. So it's metallicity, which will rise due to stellar evolution processes over the course of the universe. Those metals often are the dominant source of coolants, which are going to reduce your thermal pressure. But there's also dust. So about 1% of these, about 2% locally of the mass budget is in these heavy elements, in these metals. About one, half of that, so 1% roughly, is in these refractory small grain structures, submicron-sized grains, carbon, carbonaceous or silicate grains. And though they can also be important for cooling, but not just heating and cooling, but also the ionization fraction of most of the neutral gas can be controlled by these metals and the dust. And that, of course, affects the coupling to magnetic fields. Once we get to our goal here is to understand how the result of this gravitational collapse, and often that's stars, so we need to understand stellar structure. Evolution. So that's nuclear physics essentially supporting the star fusion in the star. And that actually leads to feedback, which is another form of support. So feedback here is from internal sources of energy, stellar, could be also black holes, which can provide, for example, mechanical feedback, which would be like a ram pressure, or radiation pressure. Okay, it's complicated. So, you know, we're trying to solve this structure and all these coupled equations, and as when you have such a problem, you basically, where to start? So locally, in the local universe, when we observe galaxies or the interstellar medium, we can see structures at various stages of evolution. We could try and identify initial conditions, but we're never really sure. The processes are happening over millions of years, hundreds of thousands of years, and so it's a very complicated problem to set up. So one recourse that we have, which is also used by stellar structure, people working in stellar structure, is equilibrium, some kind of virial equilibrium, where there's a balance between gravitational energy and internal energy. So the internal velocity dispersion, the virial value of this structure, then is related to the gravitational energy. So the virial velocity dispersion, of course, is just Gm over R.
In such a setting for this is a big cloud or something.
Well, this is general at the moment. It could be a galaxy, it could be a cluster of galaxies.
So if it's a cluster of galaxies, what about dark matter?
Yes, this M can include dark matter.
And you have to know the distribution of it.
Internal distribution. So if you are, this is a virialized condition, so virial equilibrium. So then in this situation, in fact, there's also a time scale associated with the structure, so the dynamical time scale, dynamical, which is the order, its size, divided by the velocity dispersion. And that, in fact, is in this situation is also equal to, or approximately equal to, its free-fall time. So that's the time to collapse to the center without any resistance from these various pressure forces. That's also inverse square root of g rho, density. So the reason we have so many unanswered questions in this field is because often this equilibrium condition doesn't apply, and we are trying to solve the time evolution of this very complicated system. Not only is there all this physics, which is complicated and coupled, but there's this huge range of scales. That brings me to my second topic here. So galactic star formation. Hierarchy, so the whole range of scales that we need to consider for this process. And let's just then put R, just the size of the structure, whatever it is. And some of the largest things we see around us today are sort of megaparsec structures, so that's galaxy clusters. They may have masses of order 10 to the 15, say, solar masses. Virial velocity dispersions, over 1,000 kilometers per second. Down on scales of order 10 to maybe 100 kiloparsecs, we have disk galaxies that I'll focus on. So here the masses may be order 10 to the 10, to maybe 10 to the 12 solar masses. Sigma Virial, maybe order 30 to, say, 300 kilometers per second. And here we have the first point where, in fact, the cold part of the cold universe comes in, because in such galaxies, the gas can cool through atomic cooling, so the combination lines of hydrogen. So the temperature of the gas here can cool down to less than or about 10 to the 4 Kelvin. So that's a velocity dispersion in the gas, the sound speed in the gas, which is order 10 kilometers a second. So this 10 being much less than the few hundred of the big galaxy means we have a thin disk. And the scale height H over R, aspect ratio of your disk, is of order this velocity dispersion of the gas, say like the sound speed of the gas, divided by its virial velocity dispersion. So that's why disk galaxies are thin, because they can cool down, and you basically settle into this rotationally supported structure, which is a disk galaxy. Okay, so this gas then is atomic hydrogen, H1, we write, and this hotter phase, which can be ionized, but then it can also become neutral, is the warm neutral medium. But it can also cool down through atomic fine structure cooling, so of metals like carbon and oxygen, in particular carbon 2, a thin transition which emits at 158 microns, to what's known as a cold neutral medium, and here the temperature then is of order 100 Kelvin, sound speed maybe 1 kilometer a second or so, and that's of course much colder. Okay, where were we? 10, 100 kiloparsec scales. On roughly 100 parsec scales, we see another phase of the interstellar medium appearing, and that's molecular gas, typically organized in what are known as giant molecular clouds. GMCs. 100 parsecs or so, they're certainly not spheres, they're often very filamentary structures that we see in our galaxy at least. And so here we think, well, the cold neutral medium is becoming molecular, so our composition now of hydrogen is in H2, and at least locally, we think that has to happen by surface chemistry. Hydrogen atoms stick on cold dust grains in these clouds, layers of atomic hydrogen building up here. They quantum tunnel around the surface of this dust grain. They meet, and that helps go through the activation energy barrier to form H2. The destruction of H2 is mostly done by ultraviolet photons in Lyman-Werner bands. It's around 11, 12 electron volts. So these clouds are seen in molecular gas. Actually, they're traced not by H2, but particularly by a secondary trace like carbon monoxide, or the dust emission itself, or dust extinction. The masses of these structures, this whole range, but say order 10 to the 4 to maybe 10 to the 6, solar masses are the kinds of typical masses seen in these giant molecular clouds. So now with the temperature of the gas can actually get down to of order 10 degrees Kelvin, some combination of CO line cooling and continuum emission from the dust. And that corresponds to a sound speed then of order about 0.2 or so kilometers a second. similar to the sound speed in this room. The virial velocity dispersion of these clouds is of order 5 kilometers a second, typically. And so this ratio shows you that we have a highly supersonic system. So it implies supersonic turbulence. Turbulence is operating in these GMCs. So maybe the turbulent pressure is helping to support the clouds. But it's not just turbulence. We also know the clouds are magnetized. In fact, the diffuse ISM is magnetized. That can be observed in a number of ways. Typical magnetic field strength in the more diffuse interstellar medium is about 10 microgauss, and the observed field strengths in GMCs are upwards, starting around 30 microgauss, and rising as the density goes up, just as some flux freezing as denser structures are formed. So it's some combination of turbulence and magnetic support, we think, that's at least partially resisting contraction in these giant molecular clouds. Okay, where next? So as we go to smaller scales, one thing is there have been a lot of studies about supersonic turbulence. If you can do this numerically, you can set this up in a computer, drive, stir the gas, give it some global Mach number of the turbulence, and then look at the distribution function, PDF, the probability distribution function of, say, gas densities. And what's seen is a log normal distribution arises. So that's a normal shape. If this was a linear, this was log here. That's a log normal distribution of this density. And the width of this log normal depends on the strength of the turbulence, or the Mach number of the turbulence. In a self-gravitating system, denser condensations emerge, they're self-gravitating, and we think then star formation would be related to how this power law tail of high densities emerges. So that's seen in numerical simulations, but also there's some evidence for this kind of distribution seen in molecular clouds now. Okay, as we go to parsec scales, we have structures which we call clumps, star-forming clumps. Not a fancy name, but it's precise definition. A self-gravitating gas structure which fragments into a star cluster. So of order parsec scales, but they're also often filamentary, so say 1 to 10 parsec scales. And within these clumps, we have cores, which are on order scales of 1 parsecs. These, again, self-gravitating units. They seem to be decoupling from the turbulent interstellar medium. And they are becoming, we think, individual stars, or maybe binaries. If you measure the mass distribution of stars in a cluster, so plotting again sort of distribution functions as a function of stellar mass, this would be dn by dm star here. And what's seen is a stellar initial mass function, which actually has a peak at around a solar mass. Distribution is not so different from a log normal. So that's solar masses. This is 1, roughly, the peak. And then a power law tail, the famous Sol-Peter distribution, which may well have a truncation at around 150 or so solar masses, perhaps a little higher. Now, more recently, the last 10 years, people have been measuring mass functions of the cores, and so this is the IMF, stellar IMF. The cores have a similar shape, which translated to about a factor of 3 or 4 larger masses, and there's a sort of CMF, core mass function, that is being seen in nearby clouds. And so the actual link between the two is still being debated, but it may well be that the stellar initial mass function is being set by some fragmentation process in turbulent magnetized gas. Of the stars or of the gas cores? So the stars, well, you take spectra, ideally, and you compare this pre-main sequence evolution models and stellar structure models. For the gas, you measure mass either through millimeter emission or extinction or some gas tracer. The uncertainties are typically factors of 2. in any individual mass estimate, all kinds of systematics.
Excuse me.
Yes.
Does any of this depend on the epoch when the stars are formed in the universe?
Well, yes, we'll come to that. So I'll just hold that thought, because that's on my next topic here. Where was I? 0.1 parsecs. Let's go down to maybe 10 to the minus 3.
So you're talking like today, right, our galaxy? Is that what the figures
are? What I'm showing you is mostly is built on local observations. Yeah. So 10 to the minus 3 parsecs, which this is of order 200 astronomical units. The Sun is at 1 AU from the Sun. The Earth is at 1 AU from the Sun. So this is where disks are forming, you see. And then if we go a little bit further in, maybe 30 AU, that's the peak separation of binaries. About half of all stars are in binary systems. A range of different separations. We have to come down to maybe the 1 AU, that's where we are from the Sun, and then so maybe 10 to the minus 2 AU, two solar radii, is the typical size of the actual protostar itself. So that's the surface of the star. That's where it's becoming optically thick. It's a pressurized, it's a virialized structure itself, now supported by radiation pressure and thermal pressure inside the star. So you see this, we range from a few light seconds in size all the way up to millions of light years in size, and this is just this huge dynamic range that we want to solve this very complicated problem. So it's impossible. Okay? We cannot do it. And what you'll see when you see some simulation that somebody claims to represent the universe, they will do a range of scales. Maybe they'll start some very big scales, maybe, or they'll isolate a disk galaxy, but they'll typically have to stop somewhere and give up. And they'll put in what's known as a subgrid model for all this physics that's going on underneath. Okay, so because of this complexity, there are many open questions. I suppose that's why some of us are attracted to this field. There are big questions which have remained to be answered in this topic. So I'm just going to highlight a few, and on the scale of galaxy clusters, I think this is not what I worked on, but I think there's still an issue here. Cooling flows are predicted in this very hot gas. Gas should be cooling at some rate, especially towards the centers of elliptical galaxies, and these cooling flows perhaps should lead to star formation, which is not seen, so the answer may be related to AGN feedback. So AGN, active galactic nucleus, so that's a supermassive black hole in the center of most big galaxies. So if that's really to work, we need to understand supermassive black hole fueling. And we also, in fact, there's an observed relation between the mass of supermassive black holes, and the mass of the spheroidal stellar component. So that's the stars which are in a bulge part of a disk galaxy or an elliptical galaxy. They have disordered orbits. Let's go to the disk galaxy scale. So here, a lot of the focus is on so-called star formation relations. Some people call them star formation laws, but I would not elevate them to that status. So this was made famous by Schmidt, but also Kennicott. Kennicott 98 is probably the key paper to have a look at. And what they did then is look at disk systems. So they can be disks, which are sort of big disk galaxies, the inner parts of disk galaxies, also so-called starburst galaxies, which are much smaller disks. And they plotted the surface density of star formation rate versus the gas content, the surface density of the gas, the total gas in this case. And they found a power law relation, so that this sigma, capital sigma star formation rate depends on sigma gas to something like 1.5 power, superlinear. Maybe with a truncation at lower mass surface densities, we discussed this morning. Dr. Crystal's here. She Crystal Martin, she worked with Kennecker on this truncation. What Kennecker also noted was that the surface density of star formation rate, if you plot that on a graph versus sigma gas divided by the dynamical time, the data line up with a linear relation. So basically, without trying to fit the data, he was finding that the surface density of star formation rate is just proportional to the gas content divided by its dynamical time or its orbital time. And that's basically saying each orbit the gas makes in a disk system, a fixed fraction, you can say epsilon orbit, maybe about 4% turns into stars. Seems to be a universal relation, at least from the data that was presented back then. It holds reasonably well still today, from very concentrated disk systems to some larger disk galaxies. So the question is, why? What is the physics behind these relations? Why should there be this particular efficiency, these particular relations? As we go to GMC scales, there are questions of, are they virialized? So is this condition ever really satisfied? Do they ever settle down? And that relates to the lifetime of the clouds, a long-standing issue that started going back to Frank Shoes days, back in the early 80s, still debated. You see, if the clouds live a long time, they basically will settle to some kind of virial equilibrium. If they are very transient features, then you don't necessarily expect virial equilibrium to ever be established. So then the star formation rates can be measured inside individual GMCs. And what's seen is that if you take the mass of the GMC and divide by, again, its dynamical time scale, or free-fall time scale, you have data consistent with this sort of universal relation, where there's some epsilon now free-fall, where epsilon free-fall is about 2% or so.
Excuse me, what's a GMC? There's two of us back here.
GMC is a giant molecular cloud. It's a 3 parsec scale. So this is the phase of the interstellar medium. They're small, but they have a significant amount of mass, but they actually only occupy a small fraction of volume. And we think they condense out of this cold neutral medium.
But if they have a small lifetime, what would they decay into?
Well, maybe so that's a role of feedback, maybe, destroying the clouds. So that could be from O and B stars, which have ultraviolet photons that ionize the hydrogen and dissociate the molecular gas, return it back to the atomic phase. So there's a cycling of the interstellar medium. But exactly the rate at which gas is cycled through these phases is not yet known. So on the parsec scale star clusters, we don't know, it's amazing, but we don't know whether star clusters form very quickly in one free-fall time, or if they take many free-fall times. So the actual time to turn a gas clump into a star cluster, is it 1 or 10 or more free-fall times, is not yet known.
A typical free-fall time is what?
So for a typical star cluster, like, say, the Orion Nebula cluster, which is the closest example of a few thousand stars, that's maybe 500,000 years at the half-mass radius. So in principle, you could try and determine this by looking at the relative ages of stars within a cluster, but it's actually tricky to see that. Okay, going to smaller scales then. So the cores, so why there's this small mass function, where does it come from, the IMF? There is very little variation seen in the stellar initial mass function with environment. So there's little variation. And that's the kind of environmental variables we talk about, densities, pressures, metallicity. There's no good evidence for any strong variation of this initial mass function. As we come to smaller scales, still, inside the core, disk formation is still not understood, and particularly the issue of magnetic braking. In the disk, you really have to lose a lot of your initial magnetic flux, and that requires understanding non-ideal MHD processes. You need to know the ionization fraction. It's very weakly ionized gas. That's still not known. We have the cartoon picture is a core, but it's collapsing to the disk. At some point, maybe rotationally supported, magnetized, and these rotating magnetic fields then actually seem to drive powerful outflows as well. I think MHD-driven outflows are a key part of this collapse process, partly to transfer angular momentum. They also then limit the star formation efficiency, so that they may be key, in fact, in translating this core mass function to the stellar initial mass function. Binaries, so Y is the binary fraction of order 50%. And then as you go to the star itself, there are questions of high versus low mass star formation. So in particular, you can try and model the stellar structure of these objects, the size of the star versus its mass. And for high mass stars, see, the star is still accreting here. It's growing in mass. It has some size. This is the optically thick structure. There's an accretion shock to the structure. At some point, as it grows in mass, it requires more and more luminosity to support itself. At the moment, it's quite a big, puffy structure. It's got a lot of internal energy actually built up from accretion. But as it goes to higher and higher masses, the luminosity it needs to support itself is rising, and eventually reaches a point where it just starts contracting. This is Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction, down to a point where the central densities are enough, central temperatures are enough to initiate nuclear fusion. And then you, in principle, should accrete along what's known as the zero-age main sequence mass-radius relation, the ZAMS. And so at this point, you have a stable structure which is supported by nuclear fusion as the energy source of hydrogen to helium in the core. And at this point, the star is pretty hot, and so it's a question of, you know, can you actually keep building up a stellar mass up to 100 solar masses when it's trying to accrete to this very hot structure? Okay. So now we have to go out into the universe. Okay, so we'll go out into the universe. The universe is expanding, you know, cosmological redshift, so let's plot that. Small z, we're here today, no redshift. Redshift 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 8, 10. Okay, when I was in graduate school, we were just around 4 or 5, but there's been great progress. So we can now measure globally in the universe the density of star formation. So let's write that as the density of star formation rate. So that's in solar masses per year, co-moving cubic megaparsec. That's 2, that's 1. So locally, galaxies are forming stars, but if you look out into the distant universe, they were forming stars much more rapidly. So maybe 20 or 30 times higher, peaking at around redshift of 2. But now surveys are so good, we can actually push out to about redshift of 6 or so, where it's come down to a very similar level. So there was an epoch of maximum sort of peak star formation earlier in the universe. Let's discuss this in terms of the look-back time. This is in giga years. Of course, Big Bang was at 13.7 giga years ago. So redshift 1 is, I have to remember the numbers now, this is about 8 giga years ago. Redshift 2, maybe 10 giga years ago. So that's, you know, most of the history of the universe is actually from here. The supermassive black holes that are in the centers of galaxies, we can also see their accretion history. So we can plot that on the same diagram. So again, it's the density of supermassive black hole accretion rate. This is times 3,000 or so to bring it on the same scale. That actually rises up at a similar, perhaps somewhat steeper rate, and then decreases. Fairly uncertain, but it seems to be a peak epoch of AGN activity where these supermassive black holes are accreting.
Excuse me. Can you say a word about how you observe a star formation rate?
Sure. You measure basically the metric which relate to the ultraviolet output of massive stars. You assume the initial mass function is holds steady, and then you extrapolate back to where the bulk of the mass is around solar mass. You have to calibrate that locally. Certainly, we don't really know if the initial mass function is the same as these EPOCs. So redshift 4, that's about 12 giga-years ago. Star formation rate seems to be declining here. So we try and understand this picture, theoretically, in the context of lambda CDM models of structure formation. So hierarchical. Structure formation. Because the baryons are only, you know, 5% or so of the total mass. The cold dark matter is maybe 30% or so. And this is all set, of course, by our cosmological framework, our view of the cosmos, which is essentially largely informed by our observations of the cosmic microwave background. So this was redshift 10, this was 20, 30, that's around 1100 or so, where the universe was becoming cool enough that hydrogen recombined, around 3000 Kelvin or so. Let's discuss this in terms of an age of the universe from time zero, now in mega years. So that's at around 0.4 mega years. Redshift 30 is 100, 20 is 180. Redshift 10 is about 500 mega-years coming forward in time. So, of course, we see the microwave background. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. We see fluctuations, which we think are cosmological imprints, maybe left over from inflation, which are the perturbations which actually seed galaxy formation. So the universe is recombining here. It enters what Martin Rees sort of coined the Dark Ages. The universe is transparent, there are no sources here. But the CMB also tells us, in fact, through the polarization of low L modes, that at around redshift of 10 or so, the universe becomes reionized again. So this is recombination, this is reionization. And so presumably some kind of astrophysical sources, first stars, first galaxies, maybe first AGN, are, with their radiation fields, are ionizing hydrogen. Basically, the intergalactic medium is ionized down to redshift zero. Okay, so we are beginning to probe this. There's redshift, where are we? 7.1 supermassive black hole. That's Mort Lock et al. 2011. There's a gamma ray burst seen at redshift 8.2. Tanvir et al. 2009, so that's probably related to a supernova explosion, the death of a massive star. There's a galaxy spectroscopically confirmed, although at low resolution, at redshift of 11.1. Osh et al. 16, March this year. So we, you know, we have some constraints, but very, you know, very few at the moment. JWST will enter this realm. So, you know, theoretically, we'll come back to these models. Well, these are basically n-body simulations of dark matter, plus micro, plus star formation, plus feedback, subgroup, all these subgroup models. And, you know, they try and reproduce this history, luminosity functions of galaxies, different redshifts, clustering properties, all this kind of stuff. But there are uncertainties, and I've listed them for the star formation rate, it depends on what laws. The IMF is assumed, the feedback, both from stars and AGN, just put in, all these models, very complicated models. You know, where do supermassive black holes come from? The very first stars, how do you get this thing going? We call this population 3 stars. A lot of assumptions in here, and it's not entirely clear. You know, you can vary all this stuff, and eventually you have some constraints, but I think you're more, there's definitely degeneracy here. Okay, let's talk about first stars, because this is an attractive problem in the sense that at least here, our initial conditions are set. They're set by the CMB, cosmological model. So-called population 3. That's because in our galaxy, we have populations 1, 2, historic names for stellar populations. We actually like to define POP 3 in terms of its metallicity. So they are forming from gas, which basically has a negligible, the metallicity has a negligible effect on cooling or on stellar evolution.
So for example, are there any metals? Why are there any metals?
Well, exactly. So coming out of Big Bang nuclear synthesis, you basically have just hydrogen, helium, a little bit of lithium. So that certainly would be POP 3. You have to raise your metallicity up to maybe 10 to the minus 5 of solar before, say, carbon or oxygen begin to have an effect on cooling. Maybe 10 to the minus 8 of solar initiates a CNO cycle in stars that would have some effect. But certainly, this is effectively the metallicity of Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So that's POP 3. We like to define, at least I like to define, POP 3.1. I remember this was discussed at a dinner with Andrea Ferrara, Chris McKee, and Massimo Ricotti back in 2007 in Santa Fe. This was all being discussed here. So POP 3.1, we like to say, is the initial conditions come from cosmology. Cosmological fluctuations set the initial conditions of these POP 3.1 stars. Basically, they've never been influenced by another astrophysical source. And that process then can be followed in numerical simulations, including all the gas physics, the non-equilibrium chemistry. And what you see then is these things form in so-called dark matter mini-halos. Maybe about 10 to the 6 solar masses forming at around redshifts of order 20 to 30. Okay, so somewhere here, this is this epoch of POP 3.1 star formation. And in these simulations, this is plotting the size versus the density of gas, R6. They see the gas sort of falling into these dark matter halos once they reach this potential at a certain depth. When the gas comes in, they can cool. The cooling is driven actually by H2 rho vibrational transitions. H2 here, of course, cannot form on dust, but there's a trace amount of H2 which is forming.
Dust is made out of what?
Dust is made of carbon and silicons and silicates. We don't. So this H2 forms in the gas phase, catalyzed by free electrons, the residual free electrons left over from the CMB. So they're at a level of about 10 to the minus 4 or so ionization fraction. And so, in fact, the fraction of H2 builds up to about that level, 10 to the minus 3, at this scale. So even that, just that trace amount of H2 in the mostly atomic gas can cool the gas down to temperatures of about 200 Kelvin. That's set by the lowest, rho vibrational transition above the ground state. The gas is cooling slowly and condensing and actually achieves a power law structure in its density versus radius here. It's almost isothermal. If it was isothermal, it would have a power law structure of rho going as r to the minus 2. It's slightly steeper, it warms up a little bit in the center. So as we go into, say, less than 1 parsec, at this point, the baryons dominate over the dark matter, the local volume density. So they are starting to set the gravitational potential. As you go into maybe, I have to remember now, 10 to the minus 2 or so, you reach densities, sorry, this was a density of about 10 hydrogens per cubic centimeter at this scale, 10 parsec scale, there's maybe several thousand solar masses here. It really continues out. At a density of 10 to the 8 hydrogens per cubic centimeter, then you have three body processes which promote H2 formation, and FH2 rises to what unity, you have strong cooling, and then this thing starts collapsing. And basically, this has been followed in simulations all the way to densities of 10 to the 18 and greater, basically up to stellar densities. They formed the protostar, the first protostar. They've seen the accretion shock. It becomes optically thick. So they have formed the protostar here. This is work by Walter Brom, Thomas Bell, various other groups. This is around 10 to the minus 6 parsecs, or maybe 10, you know, perhaps 20 solar radii is when this structure forms. The problem is they cannot go further because the time steps in the numerical calculations become very short on these small high-density scales. But you can take this structure and you can go try and go ahead and bravely calculate the structure of the protostar as it accretes. So as it grows in mass, this is M star here, growing from, say, 0.1 to 1, 10, 100, 1,000. And you calculate the size of the star. So this might be 1 solar radius, 10, 100. And you can calculate the structure. You know the accretion rate. It's a collapse almost of a singular isothermal sphere. So it's you know the accretion rate, which sets the boundary condition of your stellar structure model. And you can model the accretion disk, the accretion shock. What you calculate then is the star has a certain size, somewhere between 10 and 100 times the size of the Sun. But then again, as it goes more and more massive, it starts contracting by Kelvin-Helmholtz contraction down towards the zero-age main sequence where nuclear fusion is initiated by the PP chain. So these are somewhat denser, smaller than stars around us today, massive stars around us today, because they're metal-free. These are hot. So T star here is maybe order 10 to the 5. Kelvin, there's a lot of ionizing photons. Most of the energy output is ionizing photons, and we think this feedback actually can stop accretion. It's very difficult to accrete to such stars with these kinds of accretion rates. They ionize their own disks, and so work we did with Chris McKee suggests that maybe the mass of these kinds of stars will be limited to around 100 solar masses. Let me just draw a picture. In another picture here. So this is the top 3.1 halo. It's never seen another source. It's forming by filamentary accretion in the network of filaments in the universe. So it's called its top 3.1. It's the first state to form locally. It has some influence by its radiation field. So another star, another halo out here trying to collapse would be a top 3.2. It's still metal-free, but it's been affected by the radiation field. That actually promotes the electron fraction. That actually drives stronger cooling. We think their masses will be lower. If there's a supernova, it explodes, it enriches a smaller region. And so something in here would be a pop 2. So basically a normal star, which is enriched to some level. But this guy out here would be a 3.1. It has not been affected by any other astrophysical source. Okay, my last...
So Jonathan, I remember, but I haven't done it for a while, that when you do these massive stars with no metals, you get hot enough that you do a little bit of triple alpha to make carbon. And then you've made in the star enough to do CNO, and so it resets and goes back to the normal main sequence.
Yeah,
does that happen in these models? Or?
I think it doesn't, but it depends on the mixing. That may well depend on the rotation in the star, but people have... Yeah, so there's still some uncertainty there, I would say. Okay. There is a big question mark, which is a formation.
So these population 3.1 stars, this is a very narrow mass distribution?
Well, no one really knows. But these kinds of feedback models, people talk about between 10 and maybe up to at most 1,000 solar masses. It depends on the accretion rate of these halos.
So it's not quite as narrowly peaked.
Well, this is just the evolution of one.
No, I'm saying you'd expect it to be down in the sharp corner at the bottom, but it's not quite.
It may well be top heavy. It may well be narrower than locally, is what most people would say. But we have got no observational constraint yet. Supermassive black holes. Because where do they fit in? I think they're telling us something. And one of the main constraints is we have examples at redshifts, as we mentioned, of order 6 to 7. We have M supermassive black hole of order 10 to the 9 solar masses already. You know, the age of the universe here is just 800 million years. So these, you know, these very luminous quasars, AGN, are seen out of these very high redshifts. They haven't had much time to form. So how did they get there? So there's some different theories, and we're discussing some of them at this this meeting. So the so-called seeds from population 3 stars, sometimes known as light seeds. You see, if the star reaches 100 solar masses, a few hundred solar masses, it may well end up exploding as a supernova, which leads to quite efficient black hole formation. Once it gets above about 260 solar masses, a kind of parent stability supernova, which leads to efficient collapse to a black hole, is predicted. So you might have seeds of a few hundred solar masses, but that's going to grow by many orders of magnitude, probably limited by radiation pressure, the Eddington limit. It's difficult to build up to 10 to the 9 solar masses. So these models have been somewhat disfavored. There are other models, so I'll just focus on direct collapse. So this is promoted by Abby Loeb and Volker Brom and others. So here you've got to suppress H2 cooling. So that's one form of these models. So you stop H2 from forming. So this H2, where was it? It's catalyzed by free electrons here. It can be dissociated by Lyman-Werner ultraviolet. So you need a strong UV, strong far ultraviolet radiation field. So you imagine if you have enough far ultraviolet radiation sources, there could be some lucky halo that's immersed in a strong radiation field. Its H2 is shut off, doesn't form. It builds up to a more massive, atomically cooled halo, and you build up perhaps a direct collapse or something which is of order 10 to the 5 or 10 to the 6 solar masses. There are other ideas which are rapid inflow in galaxy centers, maybe driven by mergers. If you can somehow bring in the gas quickly enough onto the protostar, it's growing so quickly, it doesn't have time to contract down to this zero H mass. Mergers are sort of small proto-galaxies, gas-rich. So probably tidal interactions are driving stuff in. What I'd like to do is motivate a third scenario here, which is so supermassive POP 3.1 stars and remnants. Supported by wimp annihilation heating. So, the lightest supersymmetric particle is neutralino you guys are all looking for in the LHC. If that's a weakly interacting particle, which is the dominant component of dark matter, then you can predict how much of this dark matter density should be around. This, in most models, this WIMP is its own antiparticle, so it can self-annihilate and release energy, photons, particles, some neutrinos escape. But there is a rate of energy production by these WIMPs. So what we've done, so this is, I should reference the primary paper here, so Spolia in 08. And we followed on with Aravind and Tarajan in 09. What we've done is consider the rate of this dark matter annihilation heating in these collapse of these POP 3.1 stars. What you find is, depending on the WIMP mass, as you contract down here, you can kind of reach a point where WIMP annihilation heating actually becomes sufficient to support the protostar. So, if you have one TeV WIMP, then your number density of these WIMPs is too low to actually have much of an effect, and this thing settles down to its normal size, where the protostar is between 10 and 100 solar radii. But as you lower your WIMP mass, once we get down to about 100 GeV, so the number density of the particles going up, it's n squared times the WIMP mass is the energy release, most of the rest mass is trapped. then the heating rate goes up. And sorry, 10 GeV particles, you start to dominate heating at a larger scale. So, my hope is, well, we're still working on this, but my hope is star formation theory can make a prediction, sort of makes a prediction for this WIMP mass, because I think this is a very attractive scenario to form supermassive black holes. Come back to my initial mass function. We've never seen, despite claims, we've never seen black holes of 10 to the 4 solar masses. We see things 10 to the 5 and larger. So there's a mass function of stars on one side, solar mass, 100 solar masses. There are supermassive black holes of 10 to the 5 solar masses and greater. So there's a bifurcation. These scenarios here, they have no natural way to stop lower mass black hole seeds from forming. This scenario requires co-location of the dark matter density peak with the baryon peak. And this only happens in these pop 3.1 stars. Basically, the gas is cooling, it's trying to cool, but it's thermally supported. So these are virialized structures where in a dark matter potential, where the gas is virialized and it's balanced by thermal pressure mostly. So the peak of the baryons is co-located with the dark matter density peak. See, that doesn't happen anywhere else. Once you go to these disturbed systems, which cool, form disks, stars are no longer co-located. So this is a natural way to drive the outcome of collapse into two different directions. See, the idea is that if you're WIMP-supported, WIMP annihilation-supported, you remain very big and cool. And then you just keep accreting all the mass that's in your dark matter mini-halo, which happens to be about 10 to the 5 solar masses. And once you've accreted it, well, you've got 10 to the 5 solar masses, you may reach the GR instability, which leads to direct collapse of a black hole, or maybe you form a star, which also leads to a supermassive seed. But this is a natural way to have this bifurcation. So I think there are a lot of open questions. Certainly not everybody agrees with what I just said here, but that's what we're going to discuss at this meeting, even with you guys at the LHC. I'd like to chat with you. Okay, thank you.
So, what about primordial black holes?
Primordial black holes is another possibility. For reasons of time, there are limits. I don't know much about them. I think they come from the CMB and searches in for microlensing.
Those black holes are also a problem. I mean, the big ones in the center of galaxies today.
Well, these would be the seeds then, you see, for supermassive black holes. This situation, if the seeds are 10 to the 5 solar masses, it alleviates a lot how you can reach 10 to the sort of 10 to the 9, 10 to the 8 by redshift 6.
Jim? What about globular clusters? Is the story similar somehow? Or?
Interesting globular clusters. I mean, they have a mass scale potentially comparable of order 10 to the 5 solar masses. They don't seem to be dark matter dominated. There's a regime here where the cosmological genes mass is around 10 to the 5 solar masses here. So you have, and it stays fairly constant in redshift here. So it's possible globular clusters remember that mass scale. There have been claims, though, that if you look at massive clusters forming today, there's an initial cluster mass function, which is more of a power law distribution with no characteristic scale, and that through other kinds of processes, like tidal disruption in galaxies, you basically wipe out the lower mass globulars. So I'm not sure if people in the globular cluster community really know if there is a particular peak mass of the globular cluster mass function set physically or set by later processes in galaxies.
But sounds like we need another program.
Yeah, maybe. I think the key is essentially all of them don't have evidence for strong dark matter. They're smaller scale structures, a few parsecs in size.
Thank you.
Yeah, you briefly mentioned one-body codes over there. Is any of the dynamics that you're studying helpful to understand better baryon structure formation codes beyond hydro?
Baryon dynamics.
The baryonic constant in the universe affects structure formation.
Well, yes, so the hydro I meant was following the baryons. You mean including MHD, or? So they include heating and cooling. They'll put in a background radiation field. But you see, that's already, where did that come from? You need to know what were the masses of your first sources before you can really predict what that radiation field is. And you can't predict the masses accurately enough. So there's a reasonably detailed chemistry modules in these following the non-equilibrium chemistry. How well do we know metal production in supernovae? These things are dusty. Often we see dust at redshift 6 here. So Fabian Walter has seen all these dusty systems. And yet, locally we think dust is made in perhaps more intermediate or lower mass stars, the slow winds of AGB stars, which take time. There's not been enough time for that AGB dust production, so that's why a lot of people are interested in supernova mechanisms. Raphael Schneider, in particular, has looked at this issue of can you make dust grains in supernovae. But until you really know, it's so complicated. You basically have to assume a lot of things in these models, and then your outcome is typically depends on those assumptions.
So the first stars would be when?
So roughly 10 to the 6 solar masses, and they start appearing by redshifts of about 30. At least we look at a volume which is maybe 40 cubic megaparsecs co-moving, and they start appearing around redshift of order 30 or so. But in some rare cases, perhaps redshift 40 or 50.
And how far back can we see them?
You mean with telescopes like JWST? Well, depends on their mass. So if they're supermassive, then they'll be near the Eddington limit. They may well be just about bright enough if they're at, say, redshifts of order 15, perhaps, to be seen by JWST. But the number density on the sky may be very low. In fact, we can predict that in this particular scenario. And JWST won't have a lot of time to work. It's short lifetime mission, it's not going to survey huge regions of the sky, so we'd have to be pretty lucky. If these things explode as supernovae, again, you may well be bright enough to be seen, but again, rare. So it's tricky. JWST, I don't think we'll see the first stars if their mass, they won't see the first stars if their mass is only 100 or a few hundred or even 1,000 solar masses, despite claims as the first star machine.
I just have a question to understand the number. So the star formation rate, how does that compare to the rate at which stars die, actually? So is the number of stars increasing or decreasing?
Well, it's increasing in the sense that most mass, once we transition to having metals around, we think then the mass function of stars is something like this, which is dominated by low-mass stars, so peaking actually a little bit lower than the solar mass. So they take time to evolve. They will return some mass fraction. So the return fraction may be, 30, 40, 50% of mass returned. You should ask somebody who works on stars, maybe Lars. Depends on the mass. So globally, though, the baryonic content within our Milky Way, there's more mass in stars than in cold gas. In the universe, there's still a lot of mass in relatively warm and hot gas that's yet to form stars. But this decline in star formation activity, in large part, can be modeled as due to exhaustion of gas, of cold gas in galaxies. In the Milky Way, inside the solar circle, there's only a few billion solar masses of cold gas in atomic or molecular form, but the stellar mass is 100 million stars in the galaxy.
On that note, thank you, John.